Now, without further ado, Mr. Mighty Mouse, a.k.a. Dr. Michael Kenny. He's a fellow Michigander now, earned his undergraduate in law degree from the University of Notre Dame and a master's of law in environmental law from George Washington U Law School. After practicing trial and appellate law for some 13 years, he transitioned to higher education, serving on the leadership teams for the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law and Ave Maria School of Law. He's also taught constitutional law, professional responsibility, environmental law, and undergraduate and MBA level marketing. And moreover, he served as a director of planned giving for the University of Notre Dame. And in 2007, he was named vice president for planning and enrollment management at Madonna University. Now today, Dr. Kenny will present audio excerpts on the oral arguments in Roe v. Wade to make the case that the 14th Amendment provides protection for the unborn. In a sense, he says, a majority opinion in Roe tabled this question, claiming that in 1973, consensus did not exist about when life begins. Even if this was true, and much evidence, as he'll explain, suggests, and as we know to the contrary, certainly today we know when life begins. The well-established scientific fact is that life begins at conception. Now, knowing this, he's going to pose several questions. Isn't it time to return to the question that was tabled in 1973? Isn't it time to acknowledge that the 14th Amendment protects all human beings in the U.S. from the moment of their existence? Could Congress hold hearings and then pass legislation acknowledging that human life begins at conception and merits 14th Amendment protection from the moment when life begins? This legislation would be challenged, but ultimately the challenge would present the United States Supreme Court with an opportunity to revisit the question that has been sidestepped during the past 38 years. He gave a similar presentation in January in the Archdiocese of Detroit. It was fantastic. Without further ado, my friend, Mr. Mighty Mouse, Dr. Michael Kenny.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. It's really a great honor for me to be here. And actually, another title I probably should have would be Cabbie to the Celebrities. Let's really take a close look at Teresa Tomeo's program tonight on EWTN. I think it's a fantastic idea, and I hope that with our support, the network will pick it up and it will become a permanent part of our culture. Thank you, too, for coming back after lunch. It's not easy to come in for a talk. I went to the library yesterday to pick up some audio books on tape, knowing that I would have this drive, and I noticed a series of the greatest speeches ever given. And so I thought, well, this will be great. I'll listen to these talks. I'll pick up some of the diction that these great speakers have. And I noticed on the back of the tape that each of those talks averaged approximately 3.5 to 4 minutes. I hope I'm not going to discourage anyone, but I have been given 45 minutes, and the talk necessarily requires presenting for just about that full period of time. So without further description, I want to present to you what I would like you to think of as sort of an opening statement to the discussion about what needs to happen in order to bring America back to life. And also, I would like you to allow yourself to move back in time to the various periods of time that we'll be speaking about. And at one point during the presentation, we'll actually enter the U.S. Supreme Court to listen to the oral argument in Roe versus Wade. Now, the very professional team of audio specialists have worked to enable this to happen, and if it doesn't work, it's completely my fault, not theirs. So let me begin by telling you that the name of this talk is We Hold These Truths. We Hold These Truths. And I want to applaud everyone connected to this conference because it's a tremendous pro-life initiative. It's also a wonderful contribution to American life and culture. I mean, could there be a better title for a conference than Bringing America Back to Life? During these next several minutes, I wish to explore the impact that the legalization of abortion has had on the United States and on the American character. And then I wish to offer suggestions that are designed to help us bring America back to life. By American character, I refer to the transcendent principles in our nation's founding documents, the Declaration of Independence and the United States Constitution. America is unique among the nations of the world because we are the first nation to be founded on principles stated in advance. G.K. Chesterton put it this way: the historic glory of America lies in the fact that it is one nation that was founded like a church. That is, it was founded on a faith that was not merely summed up after it had existed, it was defined before it existed. What does this mean? How did America define herself before she existed? And how will a renewed appreciation of our founding principles help bring America back to life? America was founded on principles set forth in the Declaration of Independence. In a sense, the Declaration is our nation's birth certificate, and our Constitution, adopted 11 years later, is our nation's operating manual. The Constitution provides a blueprint for good government. By wise design, the Constitution accounts for human nature and, frankly, acknowledges our fallen nature. What do I mean by this? As human beings, we seek power, and so the Constitution wisely requires a division of powers. As humans, we focus on self-interest, and so the Constitution wisely provides checks and balances to promote the common good. As humans, we are tempted to impose rather than propose, and so the Constitution includes a division of power through dual sovereignty and a tripartite system of government. Dual sovereignty calls for sharing power between the federal government and the state governments. By so doing, dual sovereignty recognizes the principle of subsidiarity, that some matters are better addressed at the state and local level. The tripartite system assigns each branch distinct duties and limited powers. On the one hand, we can view the federal government as enormously complex. But on the other hand, the Constitution consists of only 7 articles and 27 amendments. Each article and each amendment consists of only a few paragraphs. The entire Constitution can be printed on a few pages. The Constitution describes the role and designates the responsibilities of each of the 3 branches of government. Article 1, Congress. Article 2, the presidency. Article 3, the federal courts. The Constitution's terminology is not complex. To be effective, we must know the Constitution. We must not be afraid. Bringing America back to life is noble work. Blessed Mother Teresa said it well. You and I have been created for greater things. We have not been created to just pass through life without aim. And that greater aim is to love and be loved. And we cannot love unless we know. Knowledge always leads to love, and love to service. We are a nation of laws, and bringing America back to life must proceed through law, consistent with principles of justice. But how do we know whether a law is just? A just law conforms to the natural law imprinted on the human heart by our Creator, God. We print on our money, "In God we trust." This is a reflection of our collective understanding that just laws are rooted in divine law. Our nation's founding fathers refer to natural law in the Declaration of Independence with the words, "the laws of nature and of nature's God." The natural law has been written about for over 2,500 years. The earliest known reference to the natural law appears in the Old Testament. "Deep within them I will plant my law, writing it in their hearts." This is Jeremiah 6:26 B.C., the first reference to the natural law. Imprinted on every heart, the natural law enables every human being to know right from wrong. This capacity, like inalienable rights, exists because we exist. The natural law is universal. In China, for example, Confucius wrote about the natural law 5 centuries before the birth of Christ. This is what Confucius said. "What is ordained in heaven is called the essential nature of man. The following of this essential nature is called the natural law. The cultivation and refinement of this natural law is called culture. When working to bring America back to life, we cultivate culture. We pursue and build up the good, the beautiful, and the true. By so doing, we promote the common good and invigorate an authentic pursuit of happiness. Aristotle understood this. Writing a few centuries after Jeremiah and Confucius, Aristotle wrote in 343 BC, "Law is order, and good law is good order." Several hundred years later, St. Augustine emphasized the importance of truth. Nothing conquers except truth. The victory of truth is charity. Nearly 1,000 years later, St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the most prodigious writers on the natural law, noted as follows: "The light of natural reason, whereby we discern what is good and what is evil, which is the function of the natural law, is nothing else than an imprint on us of the divine light. It is therefore evident that the natural law is nothing else than the rational creature's participation of the eternal law." Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. relied upon these principles when challenging segregation laws, unjust laws that did not conform to the natural law underpinnings of our nation. In particular, Dr. King cited St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas in his famous Letter from Birmingham Jail. This remarkable letter provides an illustration of natural law's leading role whenever our nation confronts unjust laws. And so the first principle when bringing America back to life is that justice depends upon conformance with the natural law. A foundational understanding of right and wrong, good and evil, is essential. Without an appreciation for God, the creator of all things, how can we have an appreciation for the ordering of a free and virtuous society? And without a free and virtuous society, we betray America's founding principles. Bringing America back to life involves the noble charge of integral human development, honoring the divine imprint in every human being from the moment of creation. To do otherwise undermines justice. To do otherwise corrodes all that we aspire to as a free and virtuous nation. To do otherwise leads to a distorted liberty where power, rather than truth, dictates outcomes. During the first nearly 200 years of our nation, slavery and segregation provided the most pronounced illustration of this distorted dynamic. Today, the claimed constitutional right to abortion provides the most pronounced illustration of this distorted dynamic. Just as we overcame the curse of slavery, we will overcome the scourge of abortion. By designating the human being as a non-person in 1973, the United States Supreme Court launched America into the stormy seas of jurisprudential chaos. We lost our mooring in truth. We discarded the natural law as the measure of justice. By doing so, we substituted results-oriented relativism for truth. We must return to truth to achieve justice, and we must proceed with virtue, civility, and charity. Abortion is the ultimate incivility. Abortion is the absence of charity. Abortion deeply divides our nation and corrupts the common good. Indeed, abortion is the ultimate human rights violation. Lincoln's closing words in the Gettysburg Address apply to our efforts to bring America back to life. "We too hope that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom." This year, 2011, marks the 150th anniversary of the beginning of the Civil War. Tragically, legalized slavery and legalized abortion share much in common. Both present a false notion of liberty. In slavery, the law treated slaves as non-persons. In abortion, the law characterizes the unborn as non-persons. In slavery, slave owners were at liberty to take away the liberty of another human being. In abortion, the mother's liberty unjustly usurps the liberty of the human being developing within her. The viral vestiges of slavery infected our system of justice for nearly a century after the Civil War. States passed laws that separated us into black and white. The Supreme Court sanctioned these segregation laws. These ugly, unjust laws perpetuated demeaning designations from transportation to schools to drinking fountains. When we hold fast to truth, unjust laws wither away. As we begin to bring America back to life, let's hold fast to the truths that serve as the foundation of our nation. Let's fulfill the words of our pledge. We are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. What will happen when the U.S. Supreme Court eventually overturns Roe? Two views dominate. One holds that the issue should return to the states. The other holds that the right to life is inalienable, and therefore any law permitting abortion is unconstitutional. To truly bring America back to life, the second view must prevail. This understanding reflects truth, and truth is the necessary precursor for justice. In The One-Minute Philosopher, Professor Montague Brown describes truth as, quote, the way things are. Let's consider the way things are in the context of the key question tabled in Roe v. Wade. When does human life begin? How does knowing the answer to this question impact the outcome? The opening and closing to the Declaration of Independence define who we are as a nation. These passages are key to bringing America back to life. We all know the opening passage. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the closing is equally important. The closing emphasizes our firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. The transcendent animates our nation's founding. Notice the focus on equality from the moment of creation. Notice that we are endowed by God, our Creator. Notice that because we are human beings, we have inalienable rights. Woven within the fiber of our being, these rights exist because we exist. The Declaration places particular emphasis on truth. The Declaration reminds us that certain truths are self-evident. Indeed, as a nation, we hold these truths. In today's culture, dominated by relativism, self-evident truth seems alien. But it is relativism, not truth, that should be understood as alien. What if every school day in America began with a reading of the opening lines of the Declaration of Independence? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator. Recited day in and day out, these founding principles would be better understood and integral to all Americans. As a nation, we must transmit to our children an authentic spirit of liberty, liberty rooted in truth, respect, and reality. We must hold fast to these truths. Truth provides the foundation for authentic freedom. Authentic freedom flows from an understanding of and compliance with the law of nature and of nature's God. George Washington understood this well. Consider these words from his farewell address, delivered a mere 20 years after the Declaration of Independence and less than 10 years after the adoption of the U.S. Constitution. Of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. When we gather to bring back America back to life, we stand for all that is good about America. We stand for truth. In particular, we stand for the truth that just laws are rooted in eternal law. a stark contrast exists between what we profess and what we have legalized through Roe. We profess that we are the home of the free and the brave, and yet 52 million Americans have died through surgical abortion since 1973. We profess liberty and justice for all, and yet more than half of all pregnancies in our nation's capital end in abortion. We profess that we are one nation under God, and yet abortion is the killing of an innocent human being, a violation of the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. We profess that all are created equal, and yet we permit the taking of human life from the moment of creation. We profess that in God we trust, but we are reluctant to embrace the natural law underpinnings of our nation. The Federalist Papers, essays by Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison, written at the founding of our nation, describe the challenge of framing a government. In framing a government, which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. The U.S. Supreme Court did not control itself when it issued Roe in 1973. One of the two dissenting justices, Justice White, points this out. As an exercise of raw judicial power, the court perhaps has authority to do what it does today. But in my view, its judgment is an improvident and extravagant exercise of the power of judicial review that the Constitution extends to this court. As human beings, we have two distinctly human attributes: reason, the ability to think, and free will, the freedom to choose. How we use these attributes profoundly impacts culture. To bring America back to life, we must be virtuous. The vision prevalent among so many today is that we're born, live a few decades, and die. If this is true, then living for pleasure, power, and fame makes sense. But what if it's not true? Even if we're unsure, isn't it a more humane world if every human being is treated with dignity no matter where they exist on the vector of life? Wouldn't we rather live in a world like that? An authentic vision of life begins with an appreciation of God, the creator of all things. With this as our starting point, we sense meaning. We join St. Augustine and assert, "Our hearts are restless until they rest in thee." The founders of the United States understood this. They presented an authentic vision of life. They emphasized that we hold certain truths, in particular, that we are created equal. 5 years after the Declaration of Independence, a 39-year-old slave named Elizabeth successfully relied upon these words to win her freedom. While a slave in Massachusetts, Elizabeth, who was married and had a child, she stepped in to protect her daughter against the slave owner's daughter who was trying to strike the child. In the same year, Massachusetts passed a new state constitution. Elizabeth heard a public reading of that document, met with a lawyer, and said, "I heard that paper read yesterday that says all men are created equal. I'm not a dumb critter. Won't the law give me my freedom?" A year later, Massachusetts granted Elizabeth's freedom. Unfortunately, Elizabeth's winning argument did not take hold throughout the United States until after the Civil War with the adoption of the 14th Amendment, and even then, a century passed before equal protection fully applied to African Americans. Why? Consider the impact of two Supreme Court rulings: Dred Scott in 1857, which held that Mr. Scott was property, not a person, and Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, which upheld state laws requiring racial segregation. Plessy remained the law until Brown versus Board of Education, nearly 180 years after the Declaration of Independence. Let's return to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Some delegates argued that Article 1, Section 9, which permitted the slave trade to continue for at least 20 years, was a necessary compromise. Others staunchly opposed, emphasizing that compromising truth betrays inalienable rights. John Dixon called slavery inadmissible on every principle of honor. James Madison wondered how an enlightened person could support slavery. Luther Martin called slavery inconsistent with the principles of the Revolution and dishonorable to the American character. These men understood the true American character. Like slavery, abortion is inconsistent with the principles of the Revolution and dishonorable to the American character. After the Civil War, the 14th Amendment provided due process of law and equal protection for any person. What are the civil rights of human beings when life begins? The only just conclusion is that from the first moment of existence, a human being must be recognized as having the rights of a person, including the right of every innocent being to life. Let's go back nearly 40 years to the oral argument in Roe v. Wade. Before entering the U.S. Supreme Court, notice the noble words etched on the marble edifice above the entrance, equal justice under law. Roe is one of the few cases that had two oral arguments. The first audio clip that we'll hear comes from the first oral argument, and the remaining clips come from the second oral argument, known as the re-argument. Listen as 26-year-old Sarah Weddington, only a few years out of law school, seeks to connect abortion to the Constitution.
We had originally brought the suit alleging both the Due Process Clause, the Equal Protection Clause, the Ninth Amendment, and a variety of others.
Did you notice Sarah Weddington's nervous laughter when Justice Potter Stewart interjects, and anything else that might apply? Justice Stewart seems to be suggesting that Weddington's argument lacks a basis for claiming a right to abortion. In the next soundbite, taken from the re-argument, Weddington concedes that it is possible for the court to conclude that unborn human beings are persons and therefore protected under the Constitution, particularly protected under the 14th Amendment. Notice the pause in Weddington's voice just before she makes this concession.
If the state could show that the fetus was a person under the 14th Amendment, or under some other amendment, or part of the Constitution, then you would have the situation of trying, you would have a state compelling interest, which in some instances can outweigh a fundamental right.
In the next audio clip, Weddington acknowledges that the court could conclude that the unborn human being is a person. At that point, according to Weddington, the court would be weighing one life, the child, against another, the mother.
It depends on saying that the woman has a fundamental constitutional right and that the state has not proved any compelling interest for regulation in the area. Even if the court at some point determined the fetus to be entitled to constitutional protection, you would still get back into the weighing of one life against another.
Does anyone have the right to supersede an innocent person's right to life? Justice White's follow-up question raises this point. He asks, that's what's involved in this case? Weighing one life against another? Let's listen. Justice Stewart follows up with the logical and correct constitutional analysis. Justice Stewart, well, if it were established that the unborn fetus is a person within the protection of the 14th Amendment, you would have almost an impossible case here, would you not? Let's listen to Justice Stewart.
As a person within the protection of the 14th Amendment, you would have almost an impossible case here.
Now let's listen to Sarah Weddington's reply. This is a profound moment of truth.
I would have a very difficult case.
Certainly would.
The attorney for abortion conceding essentially that she would have no case. Weddington acknowledges that the 14th Amendment protection to the unborn would end her case, which of course is the correct outcome. Acknowledging 14th Amendment protection for the unborn corresponds to truth and justice. Let's listen again. Notice Weddington's nervous laughter as she concedes.
I would have a very difficult
case. Certainly would.
It's also helpful to consider the arguments presented by Mr. Robert Flowers, the attorney for the state of Texas. Mr. Flowers asserted that the unborn human being is a person from the moment of conception and therefore protected under the 14th Amendment. Justice Stewart interjected, the 14th Amendment defines a person as somebody who is born, doesn't it? Attorney Flowers, I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. Justice Stewart, I know it does. Justice Stewart then begins to read the 14th Amendment and realizes that he is mistaken. Person born or naturalized in the United States does... Oh, that's a definition of a person, but that's referring to a citizen. Attorney Flowers responds, he's on the right track, but perhaps not as clear as he could have been. Your Honor, it's our position that your definition of a person is so basic, it's so fundamental, that is, the framers of the Constitution had not even set out to define. We can only go to what the teachings at the time the Constitution was framed. We have numerous listings in the brief of Mr. Joe Witherspoon, a professor at the University of Texas, that tries to trace back what was in the mind when they had the person concept when they drew up the Constitution. He quoted Blackstone in 1765, and he observed in his commentaries that life, this right, is inherent by nature in every individual and exists even before the child is born. I submit to you that the Declaration of Independence we hold is... At this point, Justice Blackmun interrupts, questioning the criminal status of abortion in Blackstone's time. Following Mr. Flower's response, Justice Blackmun asks the pivotal question. Is it true that the medical profession itself is not in agreement as to when life begins? Mr. Flowers regrettably responds, I submit incorrectly. I think that's true, sir. Mr. Flowers then points out that the chromosomes exist from the moment of conception and that the heart begins to beat within days of conception, but he never recovered. And he never returned to the point he was about to make regarding the Declaration of Independence. The exchange became sidetracked in minutia, but later Mr. Flowers does return to the key concept. We feel the concept of fetus being within the concept of person within the framework of the United States Constitution and the Texas Constitution is an extremely fundamental thing. Justice Stewart responds, of course, if you're right about that, you can sit down. You've won your case. Still later, Mr. Flowers strives to make the point that a human being should be protected as a person before birth. But does Mr. Flowers make this essential point in an articulate manner? Notice how Justice Stewart's reply evokes laughter. First, Mr. Flowers. Your Honor, it seems to me that the physical act of being born, and I'm not playing it down, I know it's a very momentous incident, but what changes? Is it a non-human in changing by the act of birth into a human? Or, Justice Stewart interjects, well, that's been the theory up until now in the law. Laughter. Mr. Flowers. Well, in other words, it has been the theory that we have deriving from non-human material a human being after conception. Your Honor, Justice Stewart interjects by reminding Mr. Flowers that he had asked Mr. Flowers at the outset of the argument whether the court should look at the question of human life from a theological perspective, a philosophical perspective, a medical perspective, or whether the court is limited to the Constitution. In our effort to bring America back to life, we must insist that the court take judicial notice of the truth that human life begins at conception and then grant personhood status to unborn human beings. Well, hindsight is always 20/20. It seems that Mr. Flowers was not prepared to address this point. Mr. Flowers responded as follows. I wish I could answer that. I believe that the court must take the medical research, and apply it to our Constitution the best it can. I said I'm without envy of the burden that the court has. And then Mr. Flowers makes a remarkable statement, indeed a prescient statement, one that offers focus as we work to bring America back to life. Mr. Flowers. I think that possibly we have an opportunity to make one of the worst mistakes here that we've ever made on. Before Mr. Flowers completes his thought, Justice Thurgood Marshall interjects. There's no medical testimony. And later Justice Marshall asks, is there any medical testimony of any kind that states a fetus is a person at the time of inception? But this is the wrong question. Personhood is a legal issue rather than a medical issue. Because medicine has subsequently answered the question of when life begins with scientific certainty, the court should revisit the issue and hold that human beings are persons from the moment of conception. By so holding, unborn human beings would be protected under both the Due Process and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which state, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. That's the Due Process Clause. Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. That's the Equal Protection Clause. Justice Stewart understood this logical conclusion. He then says to Attorney Flowers, if you're correct in your basic submission that an unborn fetus is a person, then abortion law such as that which exists in New York is grossly unconstitutional, isn't it? Attorney Flowers, that's right. Yes, sir. Justice Stewart, so you can't leave this up to legislatures. There's a constitutional problem, isn't there? Indeed, there is. In other words, the question of abortion cannot be returned to the states for resolution. The 14th Amendment controls. The Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses protect persons, born and unborn. No state could constitutionally find otherwise. Justice Stewart then summarized the essential point. And the basic constitutional question initially is whether or not an unborn fetus is a person, isn't it? Mr. Flowers later points out, I don't think anyone has faced the fact in making the decision whether there is a life in a person concept. Clearly, in Roe, the Supreme Court did not fully face the fact of whether the unborn human being is a person. The court sidestepped this vital issue. This is what the court said. We need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins, when those trained in the respective disciplines of medicine, philosophy, and theology are unable to arrive at any consensus. The judiciary, at this point in the development of man's knowledge, is not in a position to speculate as to the answer. Let's focus on the phrase, quote, at this point in the development of man's knowledge. Nearly 40 years have passed. Isn't it time, in justice, to answer the unanswered question in Roe? What do we know now that we did not know then? What can we see now that we could not see then? Last month, Dr. Bernard Nathanson passed away. He knew the abortion issue like no other. His life gives hope to all who seek to bring America back to life. For Dr. Nathanson, ultrasound answered the question the court declined to answer in Roe. With the availability of ultrasound, Nathanson encountered the truth. Abortion is the killing of an innocent human being. He performed his last abortion in 1979, and for the past 32 years, he has been an amazing witness for life. His book, Aborting America, published in 1979, reveals the abortion movement's brazen lies. About 10 years later, I met Dr. Nathanson. He served as an expert witness in one of my law cases. Dr. Nathanson's life is a testament that bringing America back to life with God's grace is possible. When I first met Dr. Nathanson, he had one of the nastiest dispositions that I have ever encountered. And in law, we occasionally encounter nasty dispositions. I now realize that he was suffering. He was in the grips of evil or the after effects of evil. In his writings, he deeply regrets having performed over 5,000 abortions and having overseen 75,000 abortions. By the grace of God, he was searching, and by the grace of God, many holy people came to his rescue. A few years later, I saw Dr. Nathanson again, this time in the context of his book tour for his amazing book, The Hand of God. He had gone from being a mean-spirited atheist to a humble, kind, docile, faithful Catholic. I have never, ever witnessed a more dramatic transformation. This same transformation can happen for America. We must believe. We must pray. We must grow in wisdom and virtue. Wisdom emanates from prayer. Virtue results from putting wisdom into practice. Just as we seek sustainable development in the context of ecology, even more so, we must work towards sustainable, integral human development. Over the past 40 years, abortion advocates have called for dialogue and compromise, but justice depends upon truth, and truth cannot be compromised. In Roe, the court acknowledged that personhood from the moment of conception is the key. Let's look at Roe again. Here's another passage. If this suggestion of personhood is established, the appellant's case, of course, collapses, for the fetus's right to life would then be guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment. Mrs. Weddington conceded as much on re-argument. Nearly two decades after Roe, the court was poised to overturn Roe in a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992. What happened? How is it possible that the court chose not to protect the unborn in the face of consensus on when human life begins, Remember, this is now 13 years after Dr. Nathanson in 1979 saw the ultrasound image and stopped. How could we make such advances on civil rights and then ignore the civil rights of the most vulnerable members of our society? The answer, I submit, lies in a deeper, darker reality. Indeed, the dominant reality of the past 50 years, the decline of moral norms and community standards. We have been ravaged by the confluence of pornography, the pill, and Planned Parenthood, the largest provider of abortions in America, annually funded with hundreds of millions in tax dollars. A vital step in bringing America back to life will be taken when Congress no longer funds Planned Parenthood. Recently, Planned Parenthood received national attention when video captured Planned Parenthood employees encouraging illegal activity. A lesser-known illustration of Planned Parenthood's modus operandi can be seen in an episode that occurred last November in Brooklyn. A happily expectant mother, a few weeks from delivery, was told by the hospital that newborn children cannot leave unless they have a car seat. Not having a car seat and financially strapped, the young mother recalled that a friend had received support from an entity located at 44 Court Street in Brooklyn, New York. 44 Court Street includes three offices: Planned Parenthood, Expectant Mother Care, and Dr. Emily's Abortion Clinic. Confused by the title Planned Parenthood, and 28 weeks into her pregnancy, the young mother entered Planned Parenthood's office and asked for help. The employee said that she could not help with the car seat, but could provide an abortion. Although abortion is illegal in New York after the 24th week, the employee explained that the young mother qualified for a waiver due to her financial distress. Shocked, the young mother exited Planned Parenthood's office and entered the office for expectant mother care. EMC provided the car seat. Abortion is not the spirit of liberty. Abortion is disordered liberty. St. Louis de Montfort, born 300 years nearly to the day before Roe, names this spirit as the spirit of fornication. Tragically, America is awash in the spirit of fornication, fueled by relativism, the belief that right and wrong are not absolute. To bring America back to life, we must uphold absolute truth. We must nurture respect for truth. Relativism glosses over the evil of abortion. Consider the following passage in the Casey opinion, the 1992 Casey opinion. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Notice the similarities in the following statement. The modern relativist infers that everybody has the right to create for himself his own ideology and to attempt to enforce it with all the energy of which he is capable. Who made this statement? Benito Mussolini, one of the world's most brutal dictators of the 20th century. The Supreme Court affirmed Roe in Casey to provide a backup for contraception. The Casey court made this clear. This is what the court said. For two decades of economic and social developments, people have organized intimate relationships and made choices that define their views of themselves and their places in society in reliance upon the availability of abortion in the event that contraception should fail. Where would we be if Lincoln had applied similar logic? For two decades of economic and social developments, people have organized business relationships and made choices that define their businesses in reliance upon the availability of slavery in the event labor negotiations should fail. The U.S. Supreme Court reemphasized the link between abortion and contraception 7 years later with the following words. And this comes from the first partial birth abortion case. Millions of Americans believe that life begins at conception and consequently that an abortion is akin to causing the death of an innocent child. They recoil at the thought of a law that would permit it. Other millions fear that a law that forbids abortion would condemn many American women to lives that lack dignity, depriving them of equal liberty. Taking account of these virtually irreconcilable points of view, aware that constitutional law must govern a society whose different members sincerely hold directly opposite views, and considering the matter in light of the Constitution, Constitution's guarantees of fundamental individual liberty, this court, in the course of a generation, has determined and then redetermined that the Constitution offers basic protection to the woman's right to choose. We shall not revisit those legal principles. Why not refer to medical facts rather than a matter of belief, a point of view? Let's take a closer look at the link between contraception and abortion. The FDA approved the pill in 1960. In 1965, Planned Parenthood succeeded in arguing before the Supreme Court that contraception is a fundamental right for married couples. In 1967, Time magazine placed the pill on its cover. In 1972, a year before legalizing abortion, the U.S. Supreme Court extended the right to contraception to unmarried couples. In 1977, 4 years after legalizing abortion, the U.S. Supreme Court extended the right to contraception to persons under the age of 16. Today, the contraceptive mindset permeates our culture. To bring America back to life, we must offer an alternative. We must do all that we can to promote a virtuous society. We must promote respect for the dignity of the human person. A conference held in December in Washington, D.C., analyzed the impact of 50 years of the pill. The toll on society is staggering, and the adverse impact on women's health is becoming increasingly clear. The pill is now listed as a Class 1 carcinogenic, the same category as arsenic, asbestos, and plutonium. To bring America back to life, we must live by the moral code that society lived by for hundreds of years before the pill. To bring America back to life, we must apply more rigorous standards to pornography. To bring America back to life, we must counter abortion with love. As we work to bring America back to life, let us recognize that some of the most determined advocates for abortion have been touched by abortion. Remember Sarah Weddington, the 26-year-old lawyer who argued Roe? She was the youngest lawyer ever to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court. She became pregnant while in law school. Sarah and her then-boyfriend and later husband, Ron Weddington, decided that the birth of their child would disrupt their educational and financial plans. Ron was about to start law school. Sarah went to a Mexican border town and had an abortion. And barely 2 years out of law school, she began Roe v. Wade. To bring America back to life, we need heroes. Moments ago, I mentioned Dr. Bernard Nathanson. He confronted the truth. He accepted the truth. He held fast to the truth. In 1984, Dr. Nathanson produced the film Silent Scream. The film came about when Dr. Nathanson asked a friend who performed 15 to 20 abortions a day to utilize an ultrasound camera during one of the abortions. After viewing the footage, that abortionist walked away from abortion forever. He embraced the truth. Sarah Weddington remains a pro-abortion advocate. Pray that she joins Dr. Nathanson and her client, Roe, Norma McCorvey, by embracing the truth. As a witness for life, Sarah Weddington would help bring America back to life. On April 16, 2008, Pope Benedict XVI spoke to thousands of Americans crowding the South Lawn of the White House, and this is what he said. Freedom is not only a gift, but also a summons to personal responsibility. He then described the keys to preserving freedom. The preservation of freedom calls for the cultivation of virtue, self-discipline, sacrifice for the common good, and a sense of responsibility towards the less fortunate. In a world without truth, freedom loses its foundation, and a democracy without values can lose its very soul. The human experience necessarily involves ongoing soul searching. A democracy living by truth has a vibrant soul. A democracy without truth can lose its very soul. As we go forth from this conference, let us do so in a prayerful manner, remembering that we seek truth in love, love for our fellow Americans, born and unborn, and in a special way, love for those in need of healing from abortion. As a nation, we have long known when life begins. Life begins at conception, and a person's a person, no matter how small. May abortion collapse under this truth, and may America experience a new birth of freedom. Thank you.